Okay. Tonight our speaker is from Aberdeen, North Carolina, and he is awesome. And Tom, I'm just going to have you come up and take over.
Well, thank you very much. That's a lot better than the introduction that Pete gave me, I swear. I thought I owed him something when he introduced me. Great to see you, folks. I'm Tom. I'm an alcoholic. And a member of the Primary Purpose Group of AA in Southern Pines, North Carolina. And I'm just delighted to be here. I want to compliment you on the conduct of a very good, solid meeting with a lot of content. That was really well done. Yeah. Neither one of those birds ought to drink again, that's for sure. I could tell they knew too much about that stuff. Bad cases. If it is, it's great to see all of you. I tell you, this is a serious podium, isn't it? Oh, there we are. The hiding place of the deck. Jeez, this is something else. I ought to have a smoke pot, it seemed like a... Well, I want to do what we're doing. That's just share my experience, strength, and hope, and share you know, what it was like, what was like for me, what happened, what I'm like now. And I want to tell you, I was just saying about it. I was sitting here in the middle of a bunch of folks, many of whom I'm well acquainted, many friends in this group, and so great to see you. And I was just thinking that a lot of ways to gauge the miracle of recovery. But I was thinking that when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I was genuinely as isolated as any person I have ever met. Now, I might have made a lot of noise and stuff like that, but when it came to having close, intimate relationships with people, feeling closeness with people, I was absolutely isolated. Nobody on earth knew me. And today, that same guy, there are few places in this world that I can go that I don't know people, and they know me, and if I don't get in touch with them, they get mad. And what a difference, eh? What a difference. And all I did was give a broken and wasted life to this simple program, and it's given me back more than I would have ever dared to dream. And so that's what I want to share, just sort of fill in the blanks between that. And if I have any objective other than just sort of sharing my experience, and I guess it's always the objective of AA talk is to give hope. Because I notice there are a number of new people here. And if you're anything like me, that dark period of being new in the program and totally confused about how to go and how do you get in it without getting in too deep and all that kind of stuff, my heart goes out to that. And I hope the message too. Because I want to give hope that you were dealing with a deadly illness and there is truly hope for it. Not just to stay sober, but to begin living in a real and very important kind of a way. So that's my mission. You know, I'm a guy, I'm going to try to hurry. It won't sound like it. If when you come from North Carolina, you never sound like you're in a hurry. But I'll be going as fast as I can. I'll probably talk faster than I can think. And I'll try, but that's what I'll be trying to do. I was a guy that I think much like most every alcoholic I ever hear speak. I was a guy that was just sort of awkwardly suited for life. I wasn't comfortable with this thing called life. Didn't like who I was, where I was, folks I was with. Didn't like anything about it. I was a miserable young guy. And miserable on the inside and wasn't hitting on too much on the outside. I'm not a bad looking dude now. Of course, my eyesight's failing a little bit, but not too bad. But I'm telling you one thing. I was one twerpy kid. I was a twerpy kid. I don't know if you've noticed it or not, but I have some prominent features. These, for one. I mean, those are serious ears. I guarantee you, they're serious. And that's bad enough, but they've been this big all of my life. Can you imagine a kid in elementary school walking around with something like that strapped on his head? Good God. Kids always call me Dumbo. And so, told me I look like a taxi cab going down the door with both doors open. And those are kind of awkward things. And so, you always had that kind of an awkward sort of a feeling with folk and just didn't fit well. like I've heard so many times in AA. And then when I was always fascinated with alcohol. I grew up around it, and I was always fascinated with it. I wasn't really addicted, but I watched what people did when they drank. I liked what they did. They acted nasty and did a lot of stuff. That looked very heroic to me, and I kind of liked that. And I just sort of hung around, and I would finish off what they left in glasses, stuff like that. But I didn't start seriously drinking until I was about 16. And that's the time when I got my first liquor that was mine, and I could drink all I wanted. And I tell you something, my life absolutely changed. It transformed the moment I discovered what booze would really do for me if I took enough. And that little ugly, dopey boy with those big floppy ears became a real cool dude. Now, I tell you what, I fit in. I not only fit in the crowd, I'd take it over. I mean, Flat just loved what it did, turned me loose. And I would have been stupid not to drink. I have never had anything that did as much for me as reliably as booze. Beat the devil out of psychiatry, I guarantee you that. And it really did something for me. It took that awkward guy, just transformed him, turned me loose. And so I would have really had to have been an idiot. Shortly after I started drinking, I really didn't like drunk or sober. I didn't like where I was. And I wanted out. And so when I turned to 16 for a little while, I coerced my mother into lying about my age so I could join the military and get away. Nothing heroic. All I'm trying to do is get out of Dodge. So I joined the military. Did remarkably well for an idiot. I mean, remarkably well. I don't think it says much about me. It says something about the dubious quality of military evaluations. Because when I finished training, I was... out of 1,000 guys, I was picked out as one of the 5 most outstanding guys in the bunch. That's still ludicrous to me to this day, because I was the biggest 8-ball you have ever seen. Man, I made Gomer Pyle look like a Congressional Medal of Honor winner. I mean, I was a dope. And dangerous. They caught me one time on a rifle range shooting the wrong way. And seemed to me better. Well, that's where the people in charge were. But I, honest to God, wasn't shooting at them. Just a little. I was only 180 off from the target. But in spite of all that goofy stuff, they picked me out as an outstanding guy. I want to make a leader out of me. And they were going to develop my leadership skills and going to develop my great potential. And they were going to put me into officers' candidate school and go to become a leader and an officer and a gentleman. Then about that time, I found where town was, and they found out what they had on their hands, and they changed their mind very quickly with their ambitions for me. And they reversed course and sent me up to Alaska and the Aleutian Islands. Oh, God. I mean, I don't even like to think about it. I didn't know much about it anyway. I was there for 2 years, but I don't know much about it. It seemed like it was a very hazy, foggy place. Sun might have been shining, but it was hazy and foggy to me because I changed that reality just like I did everyone I had. Half the time, I didn't know if I was in the Aleutian Islands or Hawaii, but I knew I was out of wherever I was, just if not only temporarily. And something happened. I don't understand why or how. I am not overly interested in the etiology of alcoholism. I'm sure it's a fascinating study, but I don't want to waste time on it. Yeah, I really don't have any morbid concerns about who shot John. You know, the most important thing I've ever learned about alcoholism is that I have it, to the exclusion of everything else. And where it came from, it doesn't make one bit of difference. I've got it, and that's the most important thing I know. And now I'm not the village idiot. I have some curiosity. I don't think I just woke up one day alcoholic. I won't go into it now, but I'll just say this, just for the record, so I don't oversimplify that. You know, I believe that my alcoholism grew out of the malformation of my life. You know, I believe that as I grew up and adapted to the peculiarities of my life, peculiarities of my environment, my appearance, all of that, I developed some strange kinds of things where when I get into the slings and arrows of life, I tended to internalize what happened. You know, we all experience bumps and bruises as we go along, of course. A good, healthy person will respond to the events of life and grow as a result and become stronger. There are some of which I was one, that react to situations, and rather than dealing with them, internalize the feelings. And there they grow and become infected and grow up into what we call defects of character. The things that drive my canoe in a weird sort of direction. And so I was a sitting duck. It wasn't just because of some idiosyncrasy about alcohol. I was set up. I was a natural setup. Because what booze took care of were those warped and defected ways of engaging in life. And so what happened out in the Aleutian Islands was that, well, the best definition I've ever heard of alcoholism is in the third chapter that was read here tonight. The simple little thing, we alcoholics are men and women who lost the ability to control their drinking. Best definition I've ever heard, and I must have heard 600. Best I've ever heard. Because I think it gets to the heart of the matter. This alcoholic, this man, lost the ability to control his drinking when I was 18 years old. Something happened. Now, I don't know what it was. Some people say the filter broke and all that stuff. I don't know what happened. I know that I lost control. Now, certainly I didn't know it when it happened because I'm sure I was quite drunk or else had run out of whiskey, one or the other, because I wouldn't notice minor details like crossing lines into alcoholism rather than drinking. And so, but something happened. And when I got sober, looked back, I could recognize that it was in that period where I lost the ability to control my drinking. Now, you wouldn't have seen that in the amount that I drank. I drank as much as I could before I was alcoholic. I just love booze. But what happened when I crossed that line was that if I took a drink, and I believe it would be the same today, if I took a drink, I could not predict what I would do. How much I would drink, where, what I would do, nothing. It was just, and so that was the deal. Now, I didn't recognize that. I never thought there was anything abnormal about me. I just thought that I loved to drink, loved to party, and so that's what happened. But that was alcoholism running my life. Stayed in the military as long as they could stand me. And then they had enough. They don't call it fired. I was undesirably discharged from the military for my discharge paper said undesirable discharge, unfit for military service - alcoholism. I was 20 years old. And you know about how much impact that had on me. None. Absolutely none. I thought I had pulled it over on the biggest outfit in the world. Man, I am free at last, free at last. And all my troubles will be over. And so they broke my sword and sent me out in the desert. And so here I am, getting ready to cut loose. And did, of course, the same thing. Got home drunk, laying on the floor of a train. You know, and they had to haul me off the train to demonstrate how mistaken they were about me. And it just took off from there. Now, I'm going to hit it kind of. Not, y'all mind if I take my coat off? Have I made enough of an appearance here? I mean, come on, for God's sakes, it's hot. Thank you very much. I appreciate the dress code, but I don't like sweat. And now it's free at last. But I want to just sort of cut to that, and not because of, you know, I'm a guy who loves drunkalogs. I mean, I flat love them. And now, a lot of people don't. They say, oh, geez, I don't want to hear all that, how somebody got drunk. I know how to get drunk. Let me tell you something. I don't think there's anything in Alcoholics Anonymous more important than what we're doing here tonight. The open speaker meeting where an alcoholic stands in front of his peers, or soon-to-be peers, and shares honestly about what happened, what it's like to die on the inside, what it's like to lose the ability to function, what it's like to feel desperation and embarrassment and humiliation on a daily basis, and share that. That's what we connect with. We don't connect with a lot of lofty philosophy and principles and even concepts, marvelous as they are. I've never seen a newcomer say, boy, that really made sense to me. That's not, we connect with where how we died and came to live again. That's what we connect with. So I love drunk a lot, particularly mine. Man, I get into that thing and I get into that rhythm of the old days, and then I am back there and I just flat love it. But I'm going to deny myself that since I'm in, the heck am I? Not St. Louis. So late. Good God. I spent 2 days trying to keep from falling in that lake and then forget where I am. I think the salt got to me. What happened, and why I like that definition so much, that we alcoholics, men and women who've lost the ability to control their drinking, why I love that is because it gets away from all the histrionics of alcoholism. Yeah, we'll tend to get into these kind of wild, crazy, wild west stories about what we did. About, you know, I was locked up 49 times in 1 week, you know, stuff like that. I stayed solid drunk for 40 years, never sober, you know. Right on. Yeah. you know what I'm talking about. Married the same woman 5 times. And her mother, too. but, you know, you just sometimes get carried away, and it just sounds good. Tell more of it, you know. But that definition cuts away from all that. And what I've come to understand that the heart and soul of my problem is that I have alcoholism. I lost the ability to control my drinking. I have a disability called alcoholism, whose nature is that if I take a drink, I not only will not be able to control my drinking, but I will absolutely self-destruct. I will self-destruct at a minimum, and most often will be destructive to those around me. That's alcoholism. And it's not measured by how much I drank, how long I drank, what I drank, how many times I went to jail. I went to jail quite a lot. I thought I went a lot. I was down in New Orleans one time, and they got the biggest skid row in the world, and they got stringent laws about public drunk. I went over to the jail and I asked the guys, I said, what are the laws about public drunk? The guy said, you get 3 months for walking drunk, and you get 6 months for laying down. I said, well, what is that? He said, well, if you pass out, people have to step over your side, well, you get 6 months. And so there was a judge there that sort of, for some reason, fell in love with the idea of capturing drunks, and he'd get them in the courtroom, and then if somebody came into town that was new to the area, he'd get them to come over and give them a tongue lashing. And so he heard about me, and he invited me to come over. And I went over there and talked to those guys, and after I got through, they were nice bunch of guys. I mean, I'd lived with guys like that for a long time. And I thought I'd been in jail a lot. And there was a guy came up to me after the meeting, and he said, do you recognize me? I said, no, not really. He said, do you know who I am? I said, yeah, I met you coming in. And he said, I don't mean that. I mean, have you ever seen me on television? I said, no. Newspapers, on and on. And I really wanted to help the old boy out because he desperately wanted me to recognize him, but I wouldn't go lie to the guy. I said, no, I'm sorry, I don't know you. And the boy, he was beat up, old boy. He kind of drew himself up, you know, a little pride. Everybody got to have a little. He had real pride. He said, well, I happen to be the most arrested man in the United States of America. And well, I never had anybody tell me that. And I said, congratulations. I mean, what else are you going to say? And he said, I have by actual record been arrested more than anybody in America. Now, everybody got to have something to hang on to, and I'm glad he did. I don't think I was locked up as much as him. I like to think I was locked up the exact right number of times because it's been a long time since I've been locked up. Maybe one less wouldn't have been enough. And maybe one more would have been too many. Yeah. So I think it's just right. And so, but it's not, that's not what identifies alcoholism. You know, I know alcoholics, I mean pretty good alcoholics who've never been to jail. I can't figure them out. Where did they drink? In a greenhouse or something? I mean, we did a nose count in Charlotte, North Carolina, our biggest city, in 1960. And it was just sort of an idle little, not research, but we don't do that, but it was just a nose count. And it was curious, one of the questions we asked of ourselves, there were only a couple hundred of us in Charlotte at that time, and one of the questions was, have you ever been in jail for as much as one night? Well, I thought we'd have made 100 on that. And only 30%. Now, this is when we had bad drunks. I mean, we didn't get little wimpy cases back then, man. These were hairy-legged alcoholics, man. Bad, bad dudes. Only 30% had ever been in jail. I thought, my God, that can't be. That's no criteria for alcoholism. How many jobs I lost, or how many I had, how many times I've been married, whether I'm rich, poor, black, white, brown, whatever, has nothing to do. Whether I'm gay, straight, or uncertain, has absolutely nothing to do with alcoholism. It's not measured by that. You know, those are externals. You know, but the heart and soul of, I'm a man who lost the ability to control his drinking. Everything else is circumstantial to that fact. Everything else. And that's the core belief that I have to have. And so that's what I had and what I was racing with. And what happened in my life, well, I'm not going to give you a blow-by-blow of it, but I'd be glad to, but I got a plane to catch tomorrow, I think, at 1:30. So I got to get finished by then. And so, but what happened, yeah, it's interesting to me that you hear the word denial in our society a great deal. You hear it a little bit in AA, but fortunately not too much. And I think the reason you don't hear it too much and probably shouldn't hear it much at all is not because the writers of the book didn't know the word. Obviously they did. I don't think they used it because it's an inadequate description of the phenomenon of alcoholism. I don't think it touches it. Now, denial is basically intellectual combat with the encroaching tragedies or bad news or whatever. Yeah, it's a way of warding that stuff off. What the founders wrote about was not denial. They wrote about two things. One was delusion, not denial. An inability to differentiate the true from the false is how it's expressed in one place in the book. And the other thing it mentions is illusion, an inability to see the world as it is. And that explains 100% what happened. You know, mine was not a subtle process. I was a guy who just, I mean, I started out the bottom and stayed there. I didn't ever lose a lot because I never had a lot. You know, I just basically went from one scrap to another. And what I failed to notice was that every time I would hit the wall and try to start over, I would notch down. And never observe it. You know, never recognize that what's happened in my life is deteriorating. A school child could have diagnosed me. A wino could have diagnosed me. I couldn't see it. Because of delusion, that it's not really that bad. That illusion, that it really will go away, that it's just not the real picture of who I am. You know, that thing, and so I'm banging away, and my life just seemed to be characterized by nothing but failures and new starts. And every new start was at a lower level, till I wound up living a kind of life that I, honest to God, didn't even know people live. I didn't. I mean, folks down south, we get rowdy sometimes. But, I mean, street crime, you might stick your neighbor a little bit just to goose him. But, I mean, nothing. You know, we know major stuff. We didn't just shoot up people on the street just because they were there. It was decent folk. And I wound up living in an environment that I never knew existed ever. I mean, I'd never experienced that kind of thing. It didn't exist where I was. I went up when I got booted out of the military. It's part of that delusion and illusion of life. I drifted around and I wound up, of all places, in Detroit, Michigan, and even worse, in Flint, Michigan. And I live primarily in Flint, the Flint, if you won't know it from anything famous, but you may know it from infamy. At least two times it has been voted the worst city in the United States in which to live. I don't know if that's what drew me there or what, but maybe I thought I'd fit in. But anyway, I went in there, and I lived a kind of a life that I didn't even know anything about. And by the time I got there, it seemed very natural. When you live in that, I lived in the worst city in the United States and lived in the worst section of that city. And that kind of a place there, you know, how people treated each other or took from each other was not criminal behavior. It was basically reciprocal trade, you know, that whoever was most able on a given night would do the drinking. The next night, you know, somebody would take mine and they'd do the drinking. But it was just sort of back and forth. You know, nobody called the police because everybody doing the same thing. And so I lived in that dog-eat-dog kind of animalistic environment. And by the time I was there, it seemed normal. It seemed normal. That's the illusion and the delusion of alcoholism, that a totally unacceptable way of living, and it became normal. And wound up selling my blood, $5 a throw. That was the going price. That's what I got. They would have sucked me dry if it had required any judgment to back away, but they had sort of ways of keeping up with people like me. But I would have never had the resolve to back away and say that's not a real good idea. And so that's who I was. I'm just crashing away. And I'm not talking about an old, worn-out guy. I'm talking about a guy in his late teens and early 20s. And I tell you, you can really tell when you're on a roll, when you're 19 or 20 years old, look at yourself in the mirror, you just want to throw up at what you see. To be filled with so much disgust and despair that the only real remedy you can think of is why don't you just end it? You're really on a roll when that's the best you can come up with. Yes, why don't you just end it? Everybody be better off, and probably true. And so that was going on. I'll just say one other thing about it, and that was that it's strange about this sort of inability to see ourselves, that my life was pretty much made up. Somebody read it here tonight, the little place in there where it talks about pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. First time I read that when I got in the program, I thought to myself, that is awfully lofty language for a hangover. That's how I put it together. I thought, boy, somebody got a little carried away and became a little eloquent there. But I didn't relate to it. But when I started to get sober and look back, my God, that's what my life was made up of. I was the kind of guy, I never stopped drinking because it was time to go to work. That would have been a foreign thought. Not because I had a responsibility or had an appointment or I'm supposed to be somewhere. When I started drinking, I didn't stop till I hit the wall, no matter what it was. You know, but I did, and I just set up a pattern of waking up in bizarre circumstances. It got so jail was one of the most comfortable places to wake up because I knew I was in the right place. I mean, nobody's ever thrown me out of jail and said, you're in the wrong place here, boy. Never, you know. So I just started waking up. Wake up in hospitals with stuff broken I didn't even know had been injured. It was in places where they captured me because they thought my behavior was a little weird. And then they'd see it was just another drunk getting off a deal. So that was my life. And you talk about strange places. I probably wasn't the worst in the world, but I'd sure be in competition. I tell you, I woke up one time married to a lady that I didn't even know. I mean, I was not even acquainted with her. And so I know when I saw her, I asked her some sort of an appropriate question like, who might you be, madam? And and she said, Mrs. Ivester. And I said, uh-oh. Yeah, that, whatever you're drinking, you ought not drink any more of that. I know that. That's bad news. And bad news for her. She thought she made a catch. 3 months. She 3 months later, she threw this fish back into Great Salt Lake. But I mean, that was just one of many. You know, I could go for hours about, but I won't. I'd love to. About those strange. I got to tell you one more. I woke up one. Well, two more. I woke up one night, one morning, night. In Alaska, you couldn't tell the difference whether day or night up there. And I woke up, And I thought I had a Cocker Spaniel in bed with me. And I didn't normally sleep with Cocker Spaniels. And so I see this thing, and I'm trying to push it out of bed. You know. Well, when I finally saw what it was just a minor little mishap. I had set the mattress afire. And it had burned a perfect silhouette of my body. I had one blister on my soldier, on my, that thing, that shoulder, yeah. And, but that's just something, hey. One of our old buddies out in California used to say life was would you get right down to it, our life is consists of seconds and inches. 1 second, 1 inch, it's all over. And it's certainly no credit to me, you know. But I just won. I woke up in many, many, many peculiar situations. I said I'd take two more. One, I was still in Alaska. I came to my senses one time, and I was trying to fight with a couple of guys. And I was doing all right, but I wouldn't hit nobody, though. I'd be trying to land a mighty blow, and when I start to hit, I'd knock myself down. I never did hit one of them, wanted to, but then they'd try to pick me up, and I'd go at them again. Well, those fellas turned out to be, back in the old days, when they were making up trains in a yard or something, you know, they'd move them around and hook them together and all that. And they changed rails with a big old lever type of thing that they would throw over to move the train over right a different track. These were two guys walking in front of a freight train that they were making up. And they found me draped across the rails, feet across one, head across the other. What they were doing was trying to get me off. And I'm trying to knock them out, you know. Just typical stuff. I guess I thought I was still getting thrown out of a bar. I don't know what I was thinking, you know, but that's just typical kind of goofy stuff. Only the last one I'm going to tell. Scary. I came to one morning, I was in a bed. I knew it wasn't mine, but it was a pretty nice bed. And I thought, now where am I? And if you wake up in the wrong place enough, I know I developed a sort of conditioned reflex that I would come to and show no physical evidence of it. Yeah, I wouldn't open my eyes, you know. I'd just wake up mentally and just lay there, just still as could be. Because a lot of times if you just wake up and let people see you awake, they'll just rush you with a lot of rude, impertinent questions, you know, like, who are you? Well, you don't want to answer that too quick because you don't even know what you told them, if anything, you know. So, or just as bad, what are you doing here? And you hate to say where, but you learn that thing, so you just wake up. And so I'd always wake up and listen for the sounds and try to put it together. If I heard clanging of metal, I relaxed because I knew I was in the right place. But this time, I didn't hear metal. I heard, I think, the angriest woman I'd ever heard in my life. And she's out in what I saw later was the kitchen talking to somebody and and talking ugly, too. I mean, she was talking about, who is that rotten, no good at something or another in my daughter's bed with her daughter there? And I don't know. My keen alcoholic mind just put it together. I think she's talking about me. And and I'm telling you, as bad as that woman sounded, there was no way I was going up against her. I was sick. And I laid there trying to plot my escape. And so I'm looking around, and I saw a crack in a door. So I waited. She sounded like she was in the other end of whatever room she was in. And I made a break for it and got out. Well, it wasn't as bad as I thought. I was in the house next door to mine. I only missed it by one. My God, I'd usually miss it by a whole state, for God's sake. You know, and so I felt pretty good, but nobody gonna commend me for it. But it was just that kind of stuff, you know, waking up with that kind of stuff. And every time I woke up, it was never humorous. It is after 50 years, but it was never humorous because exactly what I experienced was pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. And every time I would come to and get a look at where I was and what I'd done this time, it'd be the same old thing. Well, you've done it again. You've done it again. You're no good. You're worthless. You're irresponsible, undisciplined. you know, on and on. And look at the alternatives. The always uppermost in mind would be, why don't you just end it? Or just go away, just wander off, and just don't try to bother people anymore, just disappear. Or do I suck it up and go back and start scuffling again? And that was over and over and over. So I know what the writer was talking about, with pitiful incompetence, demoralization. And so that was my life. You know, I was obviously a disaster waiting to happen. There was no question about that. And I knew that I was capable of anything. But like any human being, I never really thought I would do mortal damage to folk. I knew I was capable, but I never believed I was. I wasn't a malicious person. I was not even drunk. I was not somebody that wanted to hurt folks. I mean, unless it was absolutely necessary. But I really didn't want to hurt people. Most alcoholics are pretty sensitive people. Deep down, we hide it well, but most of us are pretty sensitive. And one morning I came to in Flint, in where I was living, and I was in jail, which was normal. And it was no big deal. You know, I figured I was the same as in for always in there, just the same old street behavior. And after I was awake a little while, I knew the routine and saw what time it was. I knew that at about 10 o'clock the jailer came by and he would be making around to see if anybody wanted to try to make bond. And so I went up to the bars to wait for him, and when I saw him coming, we knew each other. And I said, "Hey, guy, when can I get out?" And he just looked at me and said, "I hope never." Kept walking. Now, there was no more conversation. I had no clue what he was talking about. But I knew he was serious. The man was not playing. And so I knew he was serious. And I was puzzled by it. Walked back into the tank where the other guys were locked up. And some of them in there, I guess, they apparently had heard some news that the night before some guy had been driving drunk down the main street of the city and had struck and killed two people trying to cross the street. And that they had arrested me for the crime. I had absolutely no recollection then or ever of that incident. And you know, the mind is a strange thing. You know, it won't take information in that it can't handle. Just it's a protection, I guess. And that was my. I knew I was capable of anything, but I was incapable of accepting the fact that I might have actually caused the death of two people, and I couldn't handle it. So I just pushed it away, excuse me, refused to believe it, and then gradually accepted the truth that I had, if I had done that, I'd done more damage than any alcoholic ever ought to be allowed to do. And my response was not frantic looking around for what to do. My response was I just wanted to disappear. I had no interest whatsoever in getting out, ever. I just wanted to be gone. I had family living in North Carolina, and they were never concerned if they didn't hear from me. They never heard from me. They never knew where I was. In Flint, they would call a certain bar that they knew I drank at a lot and leave messages as a way to contact me. So there was no big deal for them not hearing from me. And that was the only family I had, but I didn't contact them. I didn't want them to know. I didn't want them to be bothered with that. And for some reason, there was a policeman there. Nobody will ever know, because I never knew who he was, didn't try to find out. He just took it on himself. I think he saw the shape I was in, and he learned I had family down in North Carolina, called my folks, and got him on the phone and said, "You got a guy up here in a lot of trouble, and if you want to try to do anything for him, better come on, because he's talking himself into more." And I was just, totally, totally wigged out. And if they asked me, "Did you rob that Brinks truck?" "Oh, yeah, sure, whatever." I mean, it didn't matter what it was. I've never robbed anything in my life except another drunk. But, yeah, that's what he was responding to. So he told them, and my family did what families often do. And they made a trip to Michigan from North Carolina that they couldn't afford. To see a guy, that wasn't the first time they got him out of jail, but thank God it's been the last time for my mother. To get a guy out. Hired an attorney they couldn't afford to defend a guy that had no defense. You know, had none whatsoever. You know, the hell of blackouts is you can't admit or deny. You're about as ignorant as somebody in a different state. And so they negotiated my release. I didn't know how to tell them I didn't want out of jail. I mean, how do you articulate that to anybody? I didn't know how to tell them. And I just was a just so be shuffled around by whatever forces. And they arranged to get me released on bond, an attorney did. And I was released on the 17th of July of 56. Knew that I would never drink again. It had nothing to do with alcoholism. I'd been diagnosed as alcoholic by everybody who ever captured me. That's the only diagnosis I've ever had, is this guy is an alcoholic or drunk, a problem drinker. Heard it ad nauseum. And it wasn't to do with that. I didn't believe I was alcoholic whatsoever. But I knew I wouldn't drink simply because of the weight of guilt that I was carrying. I was ashamed to be breathing, for God's sakes, never mind drinking. Yeah, and so I didn't want to get out. I was afraid to get out. I was ashamed to get out. I was ashamed to look anybody in the eye. And so they negotiated release, and I was released on the 17th of July. I lasted till the next day. I walked the streets all the day of the 17th, all night, and then about noon on the 18th, I started to drink, of course. And from then until the 19th of November of 56, I drank literally like nobody I've ever seen. Now, that's not some Wild West statement. I have worked with thousands of alcoholics, not a few. I've worked with thousands of alcoholics. I've never worked with one like me. You know, there's a dimension, well, I won't even go into that, but there is a dimension of alcoholism that most of us never see who wind up in AA. Most of us never see. It's a dimension where we drop below the norms of society and become one of a legion of walking dead. You got them walking around St. Louis, Salt Lake. You got them walking around here. I've met some of them. I've spoken to some on the streets of this city. They're on the streets of every city, of people who make no pretense of engaging in life. They're just a subset of society, and I came perilously close to being that. Most people who go to that level never come back. Never come back. Once in a great while, I'll see one in AA, and when I do, the hair stands on the back of my neck. Because I'm looking at a living dead who's come back to life. So that's where I was. And so I just stayed blind drunk the best I possibly could till 19th November. And then that morning, I was to be tried. And I finished a bottle of gin that probably had three or four inches in it. And I finished that off and went off to court. Knew it was a one-way trip. I knew that what I was going for. I'm absolutely clueless of any of the specifics. Nobody ever told me exactly what happened. They just said that it was a horrible deal and I'd done it. And so I went into court. I testified the way anybody with blackouts will testify. You know, if somebody, you know, scooped you for something you supposedly did 5 years ago in a blackout, and you have no recollection, the best you can say is, geez, I wouldn't do that. Yeah, right. Yeah, and so I'm sitting there, and I'm listening to the case. They put me on the stand. All I can say is, I'm sorry, I don't know. I don't know. And I listened to the evidence, and it was compelling evidence. It was clear to me that this was a clear-cut case that I was guilty. No question. And that day I was found guilty and sentenced to a sentence of 5 to 15 years in Michigan State Penitentiary. And I remember that, God knows I remember that as clearly as could possibly be, that when that sentence was passed, I guess I had a very human, instinctive reaction of fear, just a normal reaction of fear, but simultaneously the most real sense of relief I'd ever known, because I knew it was over. It was over. I'm not talking about the trial. I'm talking about the life. It's over. Done. There won't be any more. And it was a feeling of just complete resignation. Not thoughts about there'll be help there or there'll be light at the end of the tunnel. I had absolutely no thoughts like that in my mind. My thought was, it is done. And the next day, they led me into to the maximum custody penitentiary at Jackson, Michigan, which at that time was the largest walled institution in the world. And there were 6,300 guys locked up behind one wall. And I became 6,301, I guess, or whatever. But I just became one of that mass of a sea of tragic faces, and I'm just with another one in the sea. And I was a really, really beat-up guy. Just beat up by what I was carrying and how I felt and all this stuff. And, you know, I mentioned I was a pretty isolated guy. I shut down like a guy in a coma almost. I didn't engage in any interaction with anybody, didn't socialize, didn't greet anybody. If somebody asked me a question, I would answer. That's it. And I never believed I would ever come out of there alive. Had absolutely no notion I would. And didn't care. And that wasn't callousness or cynicism or anything like that. It was just total defeat. I was absolutely done. I think that prediction would have come true, except for a little intervention that happened. It's profound, but you know, most profound things are simple in their essence. You know, blowing up a bomb is simple in its essence. Hitting the moon is simple in its essence. And recovering from alcoholism is simple in its essence, but it's profound. And what happened to me, I'll tell you this, and you could picture, if you can picture that zombie that's sitting there. If it had been necessary for me to exercise any initiative whatsoever to find help in Alcoholics Anonymous, I would never have come. And it had nothing to do with what Alcoholics Anonymous was. It had to do with what I was. I was such an undeserving rat, I wouldn't have asked anybody for a drink of water, never mind help. You know, and so I'm absolutely convinced that I would have wouldn't have gone to come out of their toes up. And really was resigned to that. And they stuck me in a cell, didn't speak to the people on either side of me. And one day, the thing that started to be the turning point in my life, a guy that worked there called me out for an interview, typical kind of an intake deal with social history and background and all that. Of course, he had most of mine from police records. You know, I had a record that thick, and it was all about drunk and. I have never committed a crime in my life sober. Everything I ever had was drunk and, driving, walking, sleeping, whatever. You know, but it's always that. And so this guy called me out, and he did the hill, and he got through it, and he looked at that record, and he said, "Man, you've had a lot of trouble with booze." And I said, "Yeah, I mean, my God, that's obvious. You don't need to be a clinician to observe that. Of course I'd had a lot of trouble with booze." And he said something I had never heard of and had no clue what he's talking about. He said, "We have an AA group here, and I think you ought to go." Now, he could have told me we have a colony of kangaroos, and I think you ought to join it. It would have had just as much meaning. You know, I had no clue what AA was. I never heard of anybody helping an alcoholic. That was a totally foreign concept. You know, that I hate to admit it, but I predated treatment. In fact, I predated detox, unless you want to count jail as a detox. It's a very effective detox, by the way. Yeah, if you want to get going, jail is very effective. It's short term. But I guarantee you that sucker will work. If you don't believe it, smack a cop. Watch what happens. And so this guy told me that and said he thought I ought to go to AA. And it was not a mandate. You know, we hadn't invented all this mandating and coercing and arm twisting and putting people on a leash and dragging them. We hadn't invented all that back then. And he just made a friendly statement. He said, "You got a lot of trouble. An AA group, you ought to go." Now, he couldn't have cared less whether I went or not, I don't think. And I went about my business. Had no clue what he was talking about. I didn't have never heard of AA. I barely had heard of alcoholism. I knew I didn't have it. And so a little later, he sent me a little piece of paper. It wasn't even a note, just a piece of paper. It said, "You can go to your first AA meeting February 2nd of 57. And I didn't want to go to AA. I didn't want to go to anything. It had nothing to do with any selective rejection. I didn't want to go to anything. Severely isolated people, the last thing they want is go yuck it up with somebody. But that's the last thing. And so when they sent me that, "You can go," and I said, "Yeah, right." I am profoundly grateful for one thing, and a profound believer in one thing, a lot of things, but one in particular. The most important word in recovery from alcoholism is surrender. Surrender. Absolute defeat admitted at cellular level. And thank God I had that at that point. Now, I didn't know what I was surrendering to. But I was just surrendering on any pretense of living. I just was surrendering on any pretense of scuffling. I'm just a body sitting in a cage. And I would have stayed in that cage till I died had it required any initiative. But this guy gave me that little note, and apparently it was just enough to say, "Well, walk this way." And I didn't have enough fight. I was absolutely beat. And I wandered over to my first meeting, February 2nd of 57. Had no earth. I didn't know what AA was. I thought it'd be some kind of a religious fervor that was organized or something. And I'd seen enough of that in my childhood that I didn't want to see any more of it. So I went into AA very, very uptight about what I was going to encounter for good reason. The first thing we did when I walked into AA was pray. First thing. Well, we didn't pray. They did. And so I'm sitting there listening to that little serenity prayer. That's not Sermon on the Mount. But I'm listening to that. And while they were praying, I was saying, yep, just what I thought. Just what I thought. They'll be in here deep dunking folks before you know what's happening. That's what I thought it was. Just some. Then to get up and read all that stuff. They read a ton. We didn't read much here. Even counting tradition 9 and the concept. We didn't read much. They read everything but the phone book. I swear to God, man, they had read stuff. Well, I didn't know what that stuff was. It sounded like poetry or scripture or something else. It was very church-like to me. Then they introduced the speaker, and God got up to speak. And he didn't look too bad if you didn't get close to him. He had on that obligatory blue preaching suit. And he started telling his story. And I swear to God, that fella had the most bizarre story I've heard in my life. I mean, I sound like Lord Fauntleroy compared to him. That guy was bizarre. And I'm sitting there listening to him. I said, man, somebody got to put a net on this guy. And I thought, I couldn't figure out why he was doing that. I mean, why would a decent-looking man get up in front of 300 hairy-legged convicts and just bare his soul? Made no sense. You know? And I'm sitting there dumbfounded. I'm thinking maybe he's got a little mental quirk or some sort. And I couldn't imagine. And the amazing thing was, after the meeting, I was more confused than I was when I went in. But the next week, I was back. I was back. Nobody sent for me. My chair had been empty the next week, nobody would have cared or even noticed. Didn't matter. Wouldn't matter to me. But thank God, that guy who spoke at my first meeting, and by the way, became my first sponsor about a year later, the guy who spoke at that meeting, he was blessed with the magic of enthusiasm. You know what I mean? He was absolutely endowed with this dynamic, contagious spirit of enthusiasm. And when he went through that, even though I understood none of the words, identified with not one syllable he uttered, I was drawn back, not by the message or any desire to stop drinking or to be a member of AA. I was drawn back by the magnetism of this guy's life. Thank God for that. I am somebody who deeply appreciates enthusiastic people. Deliver me from sad sacks. Man, I love people who are alive. I love people who love recovery and don't hesitate to show it. I love people who make recovery look good. It's because of my heritage. If that guy had been one of those hell and damnation kind of put you down deals, I would have never come back to AA. But I came back, and since I've never left. And so went in. And I got a... What time did I quit? It's now... 9? What time did we quit?
It's 9.
All right. Well, I got 11, so I'm 2 hours over. Well, that's North Carolina. Well, that's a heck of a place to stop. But y'all leaving at 9, and I'm not going to stand here talking to myself. And that's if you'll just sit still for about maybe 5 minutes, is that all right?
Yeah.
And I'm going to at least get you out of jail. Yeah. Well, I'll let you know a little secret. You're already out of jail. I was blessed in that I went into a strong group of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm talking about a purposeful, well-organized group that did a great job of taking new people and helping them learn the program of recovery. I will be ever grateful for that. And I'll always be a great believer in well-ordered, purposeful home groups. Because that's what I was introduced to, and that's what I've had every day of my life since I've been in AA. I was either in one or on the way to looking for one or building one. And so I had an absolute transformation in Alcoholics Anonymous in a maximum custody penitentiary. I can't go into the details, but I'll just tell you this. I became a new man there. I became a guy who was absolutely free. I became a guy who was recovered from alcoholism. There is no reward that comes from working the program of Alcoholics Anonymous that didn't come to me in a maximum custody penitentiary. That's the first place I ever knew freedom in my entire life. My alcoholism was the tightest prison I was ever in, and I became a free man, living in a bizarre subculture of a thing called prison, and I became a free man. I learned my first senses of joy and happiness and real freedom and how to be of worth and value. Yeah, I became somebody that was respected in a place with 6,300 guys, and I became a respected leader in that population. And when the time came, on my kind of sentence, 3.5 years was the Medicaid point for minimum eligibility, and I was released on my first eligibility after 3.5 years, on condition that I go to North Carolina and not stay in Michigan. And so I reluctantly agreed and went to North Carolina. Just like you were whenever you left whatever prison you were in. And we were all in one of some sort. Doesn't matter whether it's one like mine. They're all of it, with broken marriages, careers, or whatever. My God, they all feel about the same. And so when I hit the street, I was just a guy who wanted to find his place in life. I'd never been a decent citizen. I wanted to be one. Wanted to work. Do honest work, not rip people off, you know, and went to work. Never been unemployed since I've been in AA. I wanted to be of service and be a friend. And so I became immediately active in AA day one, and have been that way ever since. Got immediately active in a group and then helped develop Alcoholics Anonymous in a city. Started sponsoring an AA group in a prison two months after I was out. Yeah, I started sponsoring a group in a prison. I'm just out of one, and I'm sponsoring one. And so I was a guy that had gotten his feet on the ground, and all I am is a hungry young man just looking for a new life and a new way to celebrate recovery. And that's what I've been doing ever since. Yeah. I won't have time to tell you all about it, but amazing, miraculous things happen. As a result of, you know, I don't think Alcoholics Anonymous produces wildly unbelievable success stories. What the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous do is help us get prepared to have remarkable things happen. That's what they do. They don't produce it. They don't produce the joy. They produce the ability to find the joy. And so I just kept on digging in the program. I sponsored that group. I had my driver's license unbelievably restored 2 months after I was released from prison. 2 months. It's certainly not on any effort on my part. It was just given to me. I found out when God's got work for me to do, whatever walls are in the way come down. And they truly do. Elected DCM 5 months after I was out. 2 years after I was out, I was contacted by the state prison system of North Carolina. Now, I'm an ex-con on parole from a maximum custody institution. And a guy called me from prison headquarters and identified himself, and he was calling me Mr. Ivester. And he said, "Mr. Ivester, we're expanding the rehabilitation program in our prison system, and we were wondering if you would consider accepting a position." And the first thing I said was, "Man, do you know who you're talking to?" And he said, "Yeah, yes, I do." And he said, "We've checked you out." And I said to myself, "Man, this is weird. They ain't nothing like this." I knew for a fact that never in the history of this planet had an ex-con been hired as a professional into a prison system. I knew that. And I knew they weren't going to start with me. But if they're going to do it, they're going to start with somebody. And I can't believe a redneck state like North Carolina was the one to do it. But by golly, they did. And this guy told me what he had in mind and asked me if I'd do it. I said, "My God, man, I'd rather do it than anything I know. I'd have done it for nothing." And so I went to work. And I went to work as a professional employee in a prison system, not as a professional ex-con. I've never found a market for ex-cons. None. What I have found a market for is ex-cons who develop skills and abilities and some discipline and organization and abilities to do a job. That's what I've found. And the ex-con is just sort of happens to be part of the baggage. And so I was hired, did the best I could with every job I had, and was pulled up in the system unbelievably. I did bother to finish my college education while I was there in correctional administration. Not because I was ambitious. I just got tired of being the dumbest guy in the room. And so I just finished my thing so I could learn big words. And there's a hunger for people that are willing to be, dynamically engaged in work. And I moved into supervision, then to management, and then one day the head of our system asked me to come by his office. He normally wanted me to pinch hit for him doing a talk somewhere. So I went out and said, "Yeah, boss, what?" And he said, "Tom, I'd like for you to take over an institution as warden." Now, even though I'm in the system, it's one thing to be one of the mud wrestlers. You know, I mean, I'm just having a good time out in there duking it out with the guys. I was having a ball. And now he's talking about me being the head screw. And I said, "Come on, boss, man, I don't want to do that." And he said, "I want you to do it." And I said, "Tell me what you got in mind." And he knew me. Yeah, he didn't pull me out in a blind draw. He wanted somebody that didn't respect limits too much. He wanted somebody that had some vision to see a little further than what's just right in front. He wanted somebody that would take some risk, and he had found out that I was a guy that would do that. And so I told him after I got up off the floor, I got up and I said, "Well, okay, boss, I'll do it." And that started a 20-year increment in my career. I put in 39 years in corrections and then finally retired when I found out I was the oldest rat in that barn, and I didn't want to do that. And then so I hit the ground. The day I retired, I became the state chair for AA and corrections. They told me they needed some leadership and wanted me to take the job. And I told my wife, she was so thrilled that that poor girl. But anyway, I just took off, and we're not racing here, but I'll tell you this. I'm the busiest guy I know, and have been for as long as anybody I know. And the one point I want to say, and I know I'm cheating just a little bit on it, one point I want to say, I know people in this crowd. There are some active people here. And a lot of times when you're active, you have ambivalent feelings about how much is too much. How do I achieve this mystical thing called balance, you know? We want to get into time management and all this stuff. I'll tell you what I've come, no, not come to believe. Let me tell you what I've come to know. That Alcoholics Anonymous does not compete with anything in my life. Nothing. Absolutely nothing. And I'm not somebody who says AA has to be the most important thing in my life. I don't say that. If I did, my wife would take umbrage because she thinks she ought to be pretty important. So do I. AA is not the most important thing in my life. AA activity is not the most important thing. My sobriety, my recovery is the most important thing. And therefore, I make major league commitments to the things that mean something in Alcoholics Anonymous. So that I'm not just somebody rushing around, patting on every little fire that happens. I'm somebody who's got a committed program of action. And I just wanted to hurriedly to say this because I do know that your people are torn in that kind of thing. As busy as I've been, you know, my wife and I just celebrated 40 years of continuous marriage. I celebrated South Dakota. She celebrated North Carolina. That'll put a little stress in a marriage, you know. But if it's a marriage that's built well, she's got 38 years in Al-Anon, that helps. And the other thing is that I practice the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous in my home. You know, my family knows as much about AA as most members. And so all of my family have been involved. And what's happened as a result, just as evidence of what I'm saying, that it doesn't hurt anything. You know, a marriage, you know, I'm a guy who couldn't even sustain a relationship for a month. Now I'm in a marriage in my 41st year. Both of my kids finished college and did very well. My daughter became a psychologist and looks after troubled folk. Very proud of her. My son, I had great hopes for him. I thought he had the makings of a good AA member. He was showing great evidence, and I was really looking forward to it. He went on a class trip to Jamaica one time. And was elected King Reggae. And my wife said, "Isn't that awful?" I said, "Oh, yeah, geez, that is just terrible." And to myself, I said, "Yeah, that's my boy." You know, but he went wrong somewhere, fell out of a bunk or something. And he wound up, instead of becoming a member of AA, he wound up going to medical school. Moved into the only specialty I told him to avoid at all costs, OBGYN. And then that wasn't bad enough. He moved into maternal fetal medicine. Deals only with problem cases that are ridden with lawsuits. I said, boy, you really brilliant. And it is a remarkable man. Today, he is in Ghana, in the nation of the country of Africa, in Ghana, on a medical mission. I told him I wish he could find places to serve where they're not shooting each other, but go ahead and go get them. I'm very proud of those folk, obviously. The point is that they got extra brain power. It's not that they got extra brain power from me or their mother either, for that matter. They grew up in a home where recovery was healthily in place, where they understood. I make a real distinction between commitments and activity. A lot of people get in trouble with this thing of how active is too active by just having ill-defined things so that anything that has the AA flag is holy. I don't do that. I have commitments. I have a home group meets twice a week. My commitments be there. I have a prison I sponsor once a week. I have a lot of stuff on my calendar. Once it's on my calendar, it's a commitment. Before that, it's not. And so my family knows how to trust me. And I just say that kind of hurriedly because I know there are folks that kind of worry about that. My point is, don't worry about it. If you're operating by the principles of whatever you're in, whether it be marriage, Alcoholics Anonymous is not going to compete with it. It will absolutely enhance everything about it. So I've had a hoot. I have coming up on 52 years in February if I make it, and I have had an absolute blast, and I'm just getting started. So thanks a lot, guys. Good to see you.